we can say with certainty is that the system generates terrorism as a phenomenon, that terrorism has become integral to the way the system works. And this justifies the state's militarization of foreign policy, and it also justifies the state's increasingly draconian treatment of its own citizens.
That was Nafees Masadiq Ahmed with more or less a general overview of today's show. I am Kenneth Doust, and you are listening to the 239th installment of New World Notes. This week, we'll hear some more of the documentary film featuring Ahmed. It's called The Crisis of Civilization. And we'll end with a nice article by Bruce Dixon that updates Ahmed's points to the United States in this godforsaken election season. I hope you'll stay tuned. This program was originally broadcast in 2012. That was a presidential election year, and the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate were running on pretty much the same platform. That is most likely to be the case this year as well. Indeed, it has been the case in every election year since, 1944 maybe? So when you hear me, or Bruce Dixon, say a 2012 name, just substitute the 2016 equivalent. I'm referring to the commentary at the beginning and the end of the program. The movie in the middle is just fine. Okay, let's set the Wayback Machine for September 2012. After you, Sherman, and here we go. Global warming and climate change are phrases you will hear from neither Mr. Obama nor Mr. Romney in this sad pretense of a national election. Here are some other phrases you will not hear from either corporate-sponsored candidate. Peak oil, solar energy, massive jobs program, Medicare for all, bring the troops home, imperialism, destruction of civil liberties, war crimes, and out-of-control Pentagon spending. That's a lot of topics that the politicians are not going to talk about. And if they don't have a public argument about these topics, our mainstream media won't discuss them. So there doesn't seem to be very much to talk about these days, except what the heck is the matter with the Red Sox, and which Kardashian girl will get divorced next. Or are they all divorced? I have to confess, I haven't been keeping up with the Kardashians, or Ann Romney's horse. Nafees Masadiq Ahmed is trying to help. He's come up with 7 topics we could talk about once the Kardashians settle down. These are 7 major crises we face. Each one is a serious threat to the status quo. All 7 together will probably bring down Western civilization as we know it. And all 7 are interconnected. Last week, he talked about economic instability and international terrorism. We'll skip over climate change, peak energy, and food production for now. That leaves militarization and the destruction of civil liberties. You can see some of the way these 7 crises connect. Climate change produces social and economic disruption. States protect the interests of the powerful from disruption by using military force. States respond to peak oil, not wisely, but with more military force. Well, at least the United States does. Peak oil produces more expensive food, which produces more social disruption. Social disruption and military aggression increase international terrorism. Terrorism is the pretext for still more military force abroad, and the pretext for destroying civil liberties at home. That's not all the ways the 7 crises are interconnected, but that's enough to get you thinking that no easy technical fix is going to make this whole collapsing system stop collapsing. Not even another tax cut for the rich. Here's Nafees Masadiq Ahmed on militarization and civil liberties. And then a bit of a conclusion that is even halfway optimistic, more or less.
Overall, we are facing these multiple converging crises.
climate change, energy, food, the economy, and even terrorism, all of which are escalating.
What's happening in this context is that rather than dealing with the root structural causes of these crises,
which are often rooted in state policies and interstate policies, what you're seeing instead is states are much more able and willing to maximize their military capacity to maintain the structure of an unequal global economic system, often using terrorism as a justification. And we find that a parallel process is happening domestically. Governments are increasingly enacting more and more legislation that encroaches on civil liberties, that allows them to survey communities, monitor people's lives, their ability to control their populations, their ability to counteract the rise of dissident movements.
Civil defense is government operating in an emergency. By 10:55, the heads of utilities, Red Cross, military liaison, Civil Air Patrol, Weather Bureau, and all city departments are functioning as a civil defense team.
When you look at some of the defense planning documents that have been released from the British, from the European Union, from the United States, planning documents created by defense planners, people working in the military, what's interesting about the documents is that a lot of them show that many of the people working on national security are aware of some of these crises. They are looking at climate change and they're saying, climate change is going to be a problem. They're looking at food shortages, they're looking at energy shortages, they're looking at water shortages, and they're saying, there's going to be massive stress. It's important to understand that the people creating these plans work in the military. They're not necessarily part of a big conspiracy of any kind. They're on a salary, and they're told, okay, look at these crises, find out what's going on, let's think about it. What's driving this process of militarization is a very narrow lens of looking at the world. And again, it does come back to these implicit assumptions about how the world works, these neoliberal ideas about us living in the most advanced system possible. So what you find is that when you have all of these implicit assumptions about the way the world works, and then you're coming at it from a military angle, which is all about, well, we need to defend this society against new threats, then the only way you can respond to it, if you're going to look at it from that angle, is with guns. Even though guns are never going to solve your problem, because you can't deal with economics with guns. You can't deal with melting glaciers with guns. You can't deal with the fact that you're depleting your oil reserves with guns. But when you've paid a couple of defense planners, then they're only going to come up with solutions based on guns, because that's all they know.
The time is 11:10. This is an official civil defense broadcast.
Keep your radio tuned to this frequency.
In the UK, we have what is called the Civil Contingencies Act, which passed in 2004. The government now has extraordinary powers which it can impose on its own will if it considers that there is a national emergency. Now, what's worrying is that the things that the government is able to do in the context of such an emergency are really extraordinary. So they could confiscate property, anybody's property. They can set up new courts outside of the existing judicial system to pass judgment on things. They can cancel elections. They can set up curfews whenever they feel like, so to stop people from travelling at certain times. They can cordon off entire public areas and simply prevent people from accessing them. They can arrest people and detain them for any duration of time. What it basically does is pave the way to a full-on authoritarian state and the end of democracy.
Some people might think that I'm being alarmist, but it is alarming, and I think we should all be alarmed, because the legislation really speaks for itself.
And so this day called X, which began in such an ordinary way, is no ordinary day. At 10:35, the banshee wail of the siren echoes the warning, and the city prepares for survival.
These powers have nothing to do with responding effectively in a robust way to national emergencies. When you look at what the government should be doing in terms of looking locally, assessing the different kinds of risks, looking at what facilities and infrastructures are existing in different parts of the country. What do we need to do to increase the capacity of our facilities to respond effectively to real emergencies? What is the government actually doing on the ground to make us empowered to respond properly and appropriately? Nothing is happening. The government's not doing anything. There's no investment. There's no real analysis. There are some processes in place, but it's very, very minimal. So when you compare that level of inaction with the huge level of interest in maximizing the state's powers, their police powers, their military powers, and their powers of social control, there's this massive gulf. And it's very clear to me that all of this acceleration of state power at the expense of our civil liberties and our human rights and our dignity as individuals is happening in direct response to the fact that at its fundamental level they're losing control, and they're more and more worried about maintaining order, maintaining the status quo, maintaining business as usual. Rather than dealing with the real causes, all they're doing is dealing with symptoms, while things actually will continue to get worse because the systemic causes of this crisis convergence are still there.
I never did anything bad. Honest.
Look at yourself real close.
What I'm seeing really is that a lot of the mainstream conventional thinking is not self-reflective enough. There isn't enough capacity to look at what we have done wrong. What have we done as our societies that isn't working, that needs to change?
Welcome to the world of tomorrow. Climb aboard.
These crises really, in a way, are symptoms of a process of transition. Transition to another form of civilization, another form of social and political and economic and cultural organization. I think the urgent question that we need to be asking ourselves is what comes after? What is the post-carbon, post-peak world going to look like? And that is really up to us. It's pretty clear that we cannot continue growing on a single planet endlessly. What this means is that if we are going to overcome these crises, we need to rethink our whole understanding of the human condition and our relationship to our environment and our relationship to one another, and that we need to move away from some of these prevailing ideas and values that have dominated our current drive towards unlimited material growth, which is being driven by these consumerist values to do with the idea that human well-being is linked to increasing consumption of material products and increasing acquisition of material goods.
So do we need to ditch the whole concept of growth? Well, I do think that we need to reject the material concept of unlimited economic growth.
But we can still retain the idea of social progress, that there is some kind of moving forward, but we need to redefine what we mean by moving forwards, by getting better, by advancing. And rather than defining this in material terms, in terms of material production and consumption, we need to be defining it in terms of meeting people's basic needs, recognizing that any kind of material progress that we might make in and of itself means nothing if it doesn't cater for these more fundamental goals that all of us hold to be so important. Things like having clean water, education, literacy, things like spiritual fulfillment, things like community, family, things like well-being. There may be some material components to that, but what we find then is that the material conditions of life, rather than being the fundamental goal, rather those are simply tools to achieve these much more important values. We need to accept that the overabundance of fossil fuels has been linked to the ability to continue on this path of unlimited growth. There are many viable alternatives to fossil fuels. There is solar energy, wind energy, geothermal energy. As we've discussed, scaling up this process of transitioning to renewable energy infrastructure wouldn't be feasible. So we need to be recognizing that there should be more localization, there needs to be much less consumption of natural resources, that we need to be lowering our footprint on the earth. Renewable energy alternatives do not allow us to continue business as usual. What they allow us to do is to contract our societies to a form which is much more sustainable and much more in parity with the environment and the earth. I think certainly the way forward for looking at the banks is, at a minimum, we want to see a fundamental separation of the activities of the financial sector, where banks are investing and speculating on stock markets and shares and so on and so forth, and we have this fictional financial whirlwind going on. Separate that out from basic retail banking, where a person goes to the bank, deposits their money for safekeeping, and goes away. They want to know that their money is their money, and that banks aren't going to be playing around with that, and that it's going to be in jeopardy. That's one thing. On the other hand, we need to completely rethink the way money is created in the first place by banks. We need to accept that interest hasn't worked. It's actually generated and fundamentally created this whirlwind of unrepayable debt, which leads to cyclical economic failures. We need to be looking at the entire way that banks are structured and that money is created, and to start thinking about fundamental alternatives that communities can start engaging in now. What we're talking about is creating new forms of currency, new forms of exchange, and making them much more in parity with the real world. Communities are going to have access to land to produce food. If they don't, then they're not going to be able to eat, because supply chains are going to be damaged as a result of peak oil. Fossil fuels will not be providing food in the way that we were able to do so in the past. Industrial agriculture is failing. So in the post-peak world, we need to be exploring new forms of social organization that allow communities to open up access to land, to resources, to the commons.
And certainly we need to have a dialogue about how this happens. I'm not saying that I have a simple answer or a blueprint for the way forward, but this is something that needs to emerge organically from communities themselves. It's important to recognize that existing institutions and structures are more than likely to doggedly pursue their own vested interests, even as this accelerates global crises. But this just means that it's absolutely essential for us as communities to become much more resilient to these shocks. We're going to have to become much more localized, participatory, and grassroots in how we do things like food, energy, and the economy. And this is going to be essential for us not just to prosper, but to survive.
We've been listening to parts of the documentary, The Crisis of Civilization. I like the part when he was talking about the destruction of civil liberties. He's English, so he was talking about what's happening in the UK. Son of a gun, if it isn't almost exactly the same thing that's happening in the United States. How's that for a coincidence? So, as the movie points out, we've got at least 7 major crises that threaten to topple Western civilization as we know it, and our politicians are doing their very best to ignore all 7 of them, except for terrorism. And they are talking about that in a way that does lots of harm and no good. But at least they agree. This is Ken speaking in April 2016. Our program was originally broadcast in 2012. It ends with an essay by Bruce Dixon, also from 2012. It's about how similar the positions of the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate are. This year, the names will be different. And in recent weeks, some of Barack Obama's less important positions have become a little more progressive than they were. Cuba policy, for example. But apart from minor small details like that, Dixon's analysis is still correct 4 years later. So let us hear it again. Its title is Closer Than You Think: Top 15 Things Romney and Obama Agree On. Too much agreement between Republicans and Democrats has always been bad news for those at the bottom of America's class and racial totem poles. Even the shallow talking heads who cover politics on corporate media have pointed out the remarkable absence of disagreement between Republican and Democratic candidates on many matters. 15. Although unemployment is the highest it's been since the Great Depression, the federal government should not enact any sort of New Deal-style program to put millions of people back to work. Point of agreement number 14. Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are entitlements that need to be cut to relieve what they call the deficit. Republicans have been on the record for this since forever. And in one of his first acts as president, Obama appointed a bipartisan panel stacked with deficit hawks to recommend raising retirement ages and cutting back Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. The panel deadlocked, but Obama's position has not changed. 13. Climate change negotiations and treaties should be avoided at all costs. Obama, like Bush, has worked tirelessly to derail any actual talks that might lead to constructive international climate change agreements. Here is another point on which Romney and Obama agree. Number 12. NAFTA was such a great thing, it should be extended to the Central and South America and the entire Pacific Rim. For 4 years, Obama has pushed NAFTA-like free trade corporate rights agreements with South Korea and Central America. He is now secretly hammering out something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Point of agreement number 11. Banksters and Wall Street speculators deserve bailouts and protection from criminal liability, but underwater and foreclosed homeowners deserve nothing. Both political parties agree on free money for banksters and speculators, but no moratorium on foreclosures and no criminal investigations of mortgage and securities fraud. Point of agreement number 10. Palestinians should be occupied, dispossessed, and ignored. Iran should be starved and threatened from all sides. Cuba should be embargoed and Americans prohibited from going there to see what its people have done in a half century free of Yankee rule. Babies and their parents and relatives and neighbors should be bombed with drones in Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere. Politicians and the media have a misleading name for all this. They call it foreign policy. The realistic term for it is global empire. Point of agreement number 9. Africa should be militarized, destabilized, plundered, and where necessary, invaded by proxy armies, as in Somalia, or directly by Western air and ground forces, as in Libya. Number 8. U.S. presidents can kidnap U.S. citizens, or citizens of any nation on earth, for torture, can imprison them indefinitely without trial, and can murder them and neighboring family and bystanders at will. Number 7. Energy companies and other mega polluters must be free to drill offshore almost everywhere and permitted to poison land and watersheds with fracking to achieve energy independence. The Republicans say, drill, baby, drill. The Democratic White House helped BP cover up the extent of its Gulf disaster and has shielded BP from paying anything like the value of actual damages done to people and to the environment. Point of agreement number 6. the FCC should not regulate telecoms to ensure that poor and rural communities have access to internet, or to guarantee network neutrality. Here's another point that Obama and Romney agree on. Number 5. There really are such things as clean coal and safe nuclear energy, quote unquote. Republicans have always pretended to believe this. At the 2008 Democratic Convention, Barack Obama advocated clean coal and safe nuclear energy. Obama is building a wave of 33 new nuclear power plants across the country. The first two are in mostly black and poor communities of Georgia and South Carolina, where leaky existing nukes have already caused cancer epidemics. Number 4. Immigrants must be jailed and deported in record numbers. Republicans talk a mean game about sending them all back, and the Obama administration has deported over 1 million immigrants in his term in office, often without due process and after housing many for months in atrocious privatized immigration prisons. Point of agreement number 3, no Medicare for all. Republicans never wanted Medicare even for seniors, let alone everybody. 6 or 7 years ago, Illinois State Senator Obama was telling audiences that if they elected Democrats to national office, they'd get single-payer health care. But once in office, he excluded Medicare for All from the proposals on the table. The bill he pushed through Congress was Massachusetts Romney Care, requiring everybody to purchase private health insurance or be penalized. Point of agreement number 2. No minimum wage increases for you, no right to form a union, no right to negotiate or strike if you already have a union, and no enforcement or reform of existing labor laws. Which brings us to point of agreement number 1. The 40-year war on drugs must continue, and even mention of the prison state is unthinkable. Dixon concludes, except for stylistic flourishes, the differences between Republicans and Democrats seem to exist mostly in political marketing campaigns and inside our own heads. That was Bruce Dixon with Closer Than You Think, Top 15 Things Romney and Obama Agree Upon from Black Agenda Report. To which I will add one more point. All Republicrats agree that most of your tax dollars should be spent feeding a gigantic military machine that is endlessly employed for purposes other than defending the United States against foreign invasion. Dr. King called our bloated military a giant demonic suction tube, sucking dry our treasury and our souls. Here's a problem that is never even mentioned by our rulers. If military spending is even referred to by a politician of either major party, it's only to accuse his opponent of not wanting to spend enough. And on that cheerful thought, I thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, and please tune in again next week. Peace.